what's written on the pages echo through the ages. Shema Yisrael, you must hear Yahuwah's words so clear. In this night and in the day, echoes never fade away. David's songs forever sing. Mashiach's gift to you we bring. Lift the shofar to the sky. Yahuwah is El Shaddai. Shema Yisrael, hear the sound. A message for you come and go. Daughters of Zion, lift your voice. The time has come to make your choice. Shema Yisrael, you must hear Yahuwah's word so clear. In this night and in the day, echoes never fade away.
What do you think would have happened 3,000 years ago when Yahweh introduced himself to a young shepherd boy? His name was Dod. And he says, hello, young man. You are my chosen one. I'm adopting you as my son. I'm going to anoint you as my Messiah. You're going to be one of the most prolific prophets of all time. And in fact, in your life, you're going to live to be king of Israel. And your first act of business is going to be able to, you're going to slay a dragon. Well, not a dragon, but a giant with a stone.
Giant.
What if Yahweh said some of that to Dod and said, there's more to the story, young man. You're going to be whipped to the point of becoming unrecognizable as a human. And then you're going to face a form of executions so horrific it hasn't been invented yet. It's called crucifixion. And you're going to give up your physical body and die as a Passover lamb. And that's not the worst part. I'm going to send you to hell. In fact, you're going to volunteer to go to hell, and you're going to carry the guilt of every covenant member with you. Do I still have your attention here, young man? You know, Dod would probably be in Alabama by about a third of the way in there.
Yeah.
Oh, God. Yeah. God didn't tell him the whole story. What if you turn back the clock a little bit? I was meeting with Moshe, the sharp crag of the mountain is ablaze, and he beckons Moshe, calls him over by name. And, hey, Moshe, come here. I want to talk to you a little bit. I've heard the story of my people in Mitzrayim. Of course, you know, you were there. In fact, attaboy for you. You stood up and tried to protect a man from being beaten to death. I want you to go into Mitzrayim with me, and we're going to free all of them. Yeah, sure we are. You, me, and what army? Moshe just kind of chuckled and said, no, you got the wrong guy. But Yahweh was persistent because Moshe was the only candidate in the world that met his qualifications to accomplish this job, and Yahweh never works alone. But what do you think what would have happened if Yahweh had said, I've left out a little bit of the story here. Not only are you going into Mitzrayim with me to free my people, on the way out, they're going to turn against you. In fact, you're hardly even going to get out of Dodge before they start making religious idols and worshiping them. Your brother is even going to help orchestrate this. And that's not the worst part. I'm going to come down from this mountain, and I'm going to introduce myself to all the children of Israel to show them for certain that I, God, am the one that is speaking to you and teaching you this Torah. And when I do, rather than say, wow, is that exciting? Aren't we fortunate to be in this position? They're going to say, no, go away. We don't want to ever see you again or hear from you again.
Wow.
And by the way, Moshe, that's not the worst part. They're going to be mutinous. They're going to turn on you. They're going to threaten you. They're going to condemn you. They're going to tell you they want to go back to Mitzrayim and be slaves. And they're not going to do it once. They're going to do it over and over again. And when we finally get to the Promised Land, and I allow a few of you to go in and check it out, you're going to come back and be so embittered and disgruntled and shaken in your boots that, well, you're never going to even get them there. Ready to go? Somewhere along the way. Moshe would have said, yeah, thank you. Thank you, no. I think you got the wrong guy.
Yeah,
well, 23 years ago, a God whose name I did not know, no big deal on that at the occasion, because no one on earth had known his name for the past 2,500 years, so that didn't make me an exception, but norm. But I had disassociated from religion at the time and from politics, disgruntled by both. And he introduced himself to me, and he said that I want you to expose and condemn Islam. I certainly understood the timing. This was only 8 days after 9/11. It was a teruah. It would have been a Wednesday afternoon. The eighth day past the morning of the 9/11 suicide bombings by Muslims. And I can see why God would say, you know, I would really want you to expose and condemn Islam for me. And recognizing that no one had lived through that process, I asked the Almighty if he was open to negotiation. He said he was. I did my best negotiating tactics. He agreed to the terms, and I thought, well, that was pretty impressive, until I realized that he wrote this contract 3,000 years before he introduced himself to me. So I guess I wasn't really quite as astute as I thought I had been. But nonetheless, I go off and I meet with Al-Qaeda and the Islamic terrorists, and I write a book on that meeting called Tea with Terrorists, and I come back and I become a student of the Quran and Hadith. I'm perhaps the first person in history, 1,400 years, to reorder the Quran chronologically and put it into the context of Muhammad's life so that you could actually know what the Quran is saying. That book was called Prophet of Doom. Well, did 5,000 radio shows to promote it. Did it, wrote it by her name, lots of public speeches, picked up a few thousand death threats along the way. And you would think, well, he asked, I did. That's a life well lived. It's been great knowing you, and look forward to seeing you in the next life. But that's not exactly the whole story. He would then say, you know, I think we need to take a whack at Christianity, and ended up writing a book called Questioning Paul. Went from one volume to three volumes to four volumes, and then now to Twistianity, and it's became 5 volumes long, and completely destroys Christianity. There is nothing left of it but shreds, proving that that the Christian New Testament is absolute rubbish, and at the very best, it's a lousy job of counterfeiting. There was no Jesus. It was all about taking from what would belong to him. And before I get there, I didn't mention, but I turned Prophet of Doom into the 5 volumes of Goddamn Religion. Mm-hmm. It is by far and away, nothing anywhere close to it, the most comprehensive rebuke of Allah, Muhammad, Islam, the Quran, and Hadith ever written.
Yes.
And in it, I prove conclusively that Allah was modeled after Satan. And you would think that would be, after exposing these two religions, because no one has ever done that before, that would be a life well lived. But that really wasn't what Yahweh had in mind. Then it was Yahweh's goal to reintroduce his name to a world that had not heard it in somewhere between 2,500 and 3,000 years. Well, that's a pretty good task. And yet, I managed to study, determine conclusively how to pronounce Yahweh's name, and wrote a series of books called Yada Yahweh, To Know Yahweh. They're a series of these radio programs, Yada Yahweh Radio, to reintroduce Yahweh's name to a world that had not heard it. Well, that was what I thought was going to be the sum total of our relationship together, because at the time I was anonymous and liked being so. And then it became clear that Yahweh wanted to convey to everyone, to his people and to Goyim as well, specifically who he was, what he was offering, and what he expected in return, which means that we needed to understand the terms and conditions, there's five of them, of the covenant relationship, and how the seven, Moed Mikre, these invitations to meet with God, this witnesses to the restoring testimony, worked harmoniously to deliver the benefits of the covenant, which there are five of those. That was, I thought, a reasonable, in fact, a monumental work.
Yeah.
And then there was something that was far more important to Yahweh than all of those things, and that's saying something, I guess, at this point, and that was that there is one among us that Yahweh loves more than anyone else. There's one that Yahweh chose. There is one that he anointed Messiah three times. There's one that he says, you are my son, I am your father. And his name is Dod. And we wrote a series of books called Coming Home about Dod's Moed Mizmor, his songs, which we came to say, no, Bar Kokhba and his star that you put on your Israeli flag, no, that's not right. And this other guy that Christians are calling the Christ and the Son of God, no, that's not right either. Dod is the Messiah. He's the Son of God. Well, that was pretty controversial. And putting these things together, that certainly would have been a life well lived. But that wasn't even the beginning of it. Then this preference that I had for anonymity, which I thought would be really helpful under these things, since I was completely denouncing religion, Yahweh said, "No, we're not gonna be anonymous." And we found references to a choter, an entire chapter of Yeshayahu was written on the behalf of introducing the choter. It turns out the entire book of Yeshayahu is the textbook on the proper technique for chotering.
Chotering.
and then you have Solomon as he's laid the cornerstone. He's now erected Yahweh's home on Mount Moriah. He's giving the actual Sermon on the Mount. And he says there's going to be an Acre, an observant foreigner, and that he will come in the last days, and he is going to be responsible for awakening Israel and bringing his people home. And you find that there are some 20 titles and many hundreds of prophecies, and that this role is among the two or three most important in the story that God tells his people. It's so important that there are only three Zeroah, of which he is one of the three. Moshe is the first, Dod is the second. He's the third. And so you now realize that you have a very important role to play in all of this. And then somewhere along the way, it was in writing the books of Babel, disproving the book of Ezekiel, and again then following through with goddamn religion for exposing and condemning Islam, that I began to realize that the reason that this is so important is that the world has gone for 2,500 years without knowing who Yahweh is, what he is offering, what he expects in return, what his Moed Mikre mean, who fulfilled them, how they were fulfilled, when they were fulfilled, when will they be fulfilled, as a result, unless somebody did much more than I have done up to this point, there would be no one to bring home, to harvest on Shabuah or on Teruah, and even more importantly, there would be no homecoming or family reunion on Yom Kippurim, because no one would know who Yahweh is, when he's returning, uh-huh, or what one needed to do to capitalize on this and be ready for him.
Mm-hmm.
And then all of a sudden, I realized this is the ultimate battle for the redemption, the salvation, the reconciliation of Yisrael and Yehudim. And we either,
yes,
do this job correctly and well, or life is for naught. Planet's destroyed. God never returns. And so that made me the adversary's adversary, because what Satan needs is for him to continue to be the God of Islam, of Christianity, of Judaism, to keep people in the dark about when Yahweh is scheduled to return, of what these harvests represent, of what they need to do to prepare themselves for it. Because if there is no one to harvest on Shabuah, on Teruah, which there would not have been, nor anyone there for that homecoming and family reunion on the Day of Reconciliations, Satan wins. It's his planet.
Mm-hmm.
All of a sudden, the mission becomes very serious. But that wasn't enough. The single greatest discovery of my life, and probably of any life over the past 2,500 years, was the recognition that Dod, the Messiah and Son of God, the past and future King of Yisrael, he fulfilled Pesach, Matzah, and Bikurim in his second of three lives. He, this mighty Lion of Judah, became the Passover Lamb. And then on Matzah, his soul took our guilt and carried it into Sheol to deposit it there to make us look perfect before God. And then he became the firstborn on Bikurim, firstborn children, to show us the way, so that we could be enriched and empowered by Yahweh. Now, that's the most important discovery in the long history of humankind.
Mm-hmm.
And so we shared that, and we said, well, that's, we'll update the books for that. And now we have like 35 books on the shelf. We get them corrected for that, and we are good to go. It has been a life well lived. That was not enough.
Mm-hmm.
What you're going to hear as we go through this textbook on proper chodering and how to recognize and bond to a choder, Yashaya, and we're going to commence in the 17th chapter. And I'm going to summarize the first five verses, although I could write a book about almost each of these verses.
Sure.
And we're going to get to the sixth verse, and we're going to read some things that are life-altering, beyond most anything you could possibly imagine, that takes this mission that Yahweh has assigned his final Zeruah and takes it to a place. Well, I've shared it with Kirk. I've shared it with the Dean. I've shared it with my wife and two or three others. It takes us to a place beyond where any of us could possibly have imagined. So before I begin, Kirk, Dee, is there anything you want to add, or do we marshaling through Isaiah 7?
No.
I say let's get to it. Nothing I say is as important.
Yeah. Yeah. No. They've cheated. They know where we're going this evening. I sent them.
True.
I sent him what I had translated these last few days. Mm-hmm. While, and I can, just before I start this, I've started the first word, while. If Yahweh had told me 23 years ago, it'll be 32 when it's all over, that this is where this job was going to lead. I would have turned and I would have melted right there. There'd been nothing to even scrape up from the pavement. So this is for shock value. Covenant members and those listening to this program, particularly Israelites, this is as shocking as anything you have probably ever heard. And yet it has been written in the scroll of Yashaya, the entirety of which has been preserved among the Dead Sea Scrolls. And it is written boldly in the Torah.
Mm-hmm.
This should have not have been a secret. And yet, we are the first to realize what we're going to share with you. So while Shavuot, which is a harvest of standing grain, is the last opportunity to leave this planet before it spins out of control in anti-Semitic rage, a great deal is going to occur between May 22nd, 2026, which is when the Shavuot harvest will be manifest, and the first of Abib in 2030. I believe that's on April 4th of that year, when the witnesses will arrive to confront the Torahless One, the corporeal manifestation of HaSatan, the adversary. And they will, in addition to confronting him, be there to encourage Yehudim, Jews, the beloved of Yah, to participate in the final lakat, which is a gleaning, which will take place on Teruah. That date, 3.5 years after their arrival, it will be September 23rd and 24th. In 2033, year 6000 Yah. So as we contemplate what Yashaya reveals next, and this I'm sharing with you comes after a comprehensive analysis of the first five verses of the 17th chapter of Yashaya. Since it flows out of those previous revelations, I'm going to present them in summary form so that you have the context as we consider Yashaya 17:6. A prophetic pronouncement and a timely declaration regarding the removal of the tremendous burden of Damascus. Behold, Damascus is revolting and corrupt, degenerate and unrestrained, and it will be removed from inhabited cities. It will actually become a twisted and tangled heap of collapsed structures, fallen buildings, and rubble. Yashaya Isaiah 17:1. Abandoned and damned, destroyed and deserted, will be the inhabited and terrorized regions of anguished cities filled with disgusting religious temples and shrines, as well as wrathful donkeys of Aror, the repudiated outcasts and repugnant refugees of the Arnon Valley and Ammon Jordan. For there will be roaming animals fighting in militant militias along with their helpers, but they will cease and prostrate themselves because there will be no one left to terrorize. So the fortified city and the defensive structures will cease to exist as a result of Ephraim, Israel, along with the government out of Damascus, including the residue left of Aram, Syria, including some of the military influence over Iran, Iraq, and Jordan, for having been similarly vehement, burdensome, fanatical, and dim-witted. The children of Israel, however, those who engage and endure with God, will actually continue to exist, prophetically declares Yahweh, of the vast array of spiritual messengers and envoys. To comment on this briefly, we know that as a result of America's ill-fated invasion of Iraq, that Iraq was ceded to Iran. Mm-hmm. And that when Iraq became under the control of the mullahs of Iran, then Assad had no place to turn for support, yeah, since he's not an oil-rich nation. And he had been a fellow Baathist with Saddam Hussein, but now he became a client of the Ayatollahs. And that, mm-hmm, means that he had to accept Hezbollah and weapons transfers through Syria into Lebanon. And that's where they come from. So what this is saying is that all of the war between Shia and Sunni in Syria and position between the United States, China, and Iran on one side and the United States, Europe, and some Sunni Muslim nations on the other, that this powder keg that is going to ignite world conflict is going to lead to the downfall of the Syrian government, but the virtual obliteration of Damascus is going to be a heap of crumbled buildings. And it's going to happen as a result of Israel. So as Israel goes into Lebanon, as the IDF is doing now, to neuter Hezbollah, Allah's party, and to rid Hezbollah of the rockets that it is raining down by the hundreds per day into northern Israel, that the stockpile of weaponry is not going to be in easy reach of Israel in the southern part of Lebanon. It's going to be in and around Damascus, and as Muslims do, they're going to use women and children as shields for their, mm-hmm, stores of weapons. And it's going to put Israel in a position where it either destroys those weapons and destroys Damascus along with them, or is destroyed by them. And Israel's in a fight for its very existence. And so this is what we've been told. Now, previous to this, I had gone through all of the scenarios that had to happen for this to come to be. I mean, Yeshaya wrote 2,700 years ago, this didn't even seem remotely possible until about 10 years ago. Mm-hmm. And now it's inevitable. And so you do have to put that into context as to how a reconstituted Israel would end the inhabited existence of the longest continually inhabited city in the world, Damascus, or why God hates Damascus so. Damascus was the headquarters of Islam, of the Islamic Caliphate, mm-hmm, when Islam wiped out approximately one-third of the population of the known world and imposed itself not only over Israel but over much of the world. And it was on the way to and in Damascus that Paul became demon-possessed and, mm-hmm, conspired to create Christianity as a counterfeit for what Dodd had done for us on Pesach, Matzah, and Makorim as the Messiah and Son of God. So God hates Damascus. Mm-hmm. In fact, Ishmael, whom Abraham wanted to be the heir of the covenant, he had a servant that, yeah, had come from Damascus, and he said, you know, can this guy be the heir to the covenant? God said, no. Absolutely, unequivocally, no. Of course, he said the same thing about Ishmael, who became, mm-hmm, the forefather of Islam. So that's where we are in this scenario. That is going to trigger the things that follow. And it will actually transpire in that day, at this time, that the size of Jacob, that is Israel, will be decreased to the point of no longer being sustainable or viable. The fattest, best protected, and most important place at the midsection of his physical existence will be leaned and wastefully sacrificed as part of the sickening agenda of world leaders, Yeshaya 17:4. This is the two-state disillusion. This is the Neville Chamberlain moment that brings the world into its final war. This is the progressive mantra that is based on rewarding ruthless terrorists who have tried to destroy Jews and Israel for the last 1,400 years and who perpetrated the savagery of 10/7 and rewarding them with a state carved out of the heart of Israel and using borders which the Muslims have never accepted on promises of peace which they will never honor. Then there will exist something which can be compared to the collecting and bringing together of an intensely dramatic ingathering, the removal and receiving, asaf, of a harvest, cutting away and reaping during a short but vexing time, ketzir, of standing grain, of deeply rooted, steadfast, upright, and established. Come on. And his Zeruah, the one who is cultivating the seeds for his harvest to be fruitful and productive, will reap the harvest with unfolding implications, cutting the valued crop away from a troubling time of first fruits forming an overflowing torrent moving swiftly from one place to another in linear fashion as a result of the stem off this main branch, Shibboleth. In addition, there will be at a time certain that which is similar to a rapid gleaning of what is left in a final ingathering to be quickly prepared and removed, a lakat, of first fruits flowing from one place to another in linear fashion in the profound depths of Raphaim, where the sick have been healed and defective have been restored, while the feeble falter and the souls of the dead remain. Yeshaya 17:5. So, at the time that a two-state dissolution is imposed on Israel, there is going to be a harvest, a katsir, of standing grain. And that harvest is of confirmed covenant members, whom Yahweh views as family and doesn't want to have to witness or get caught up in the time of Jacob's troubles, which commence on this same day. Shabuah is a Shabbat 7 years prior to Yahweh and Dod's return, 2026, commencing the time of Jacob's troubles. And that is when this harvest of standing grain will occur. It is of both Goyim and of Israelites, represented by the fact that Yahweh will tell us, and we'll look at this momentarily, that it is a harvest of varieties of wheats, representing different ethnicities. And it is on Shabuah that foreigners and Israelites gather together, men and women, rich and poor, people from all wings, rows and status of life situations come together to celebrate it, and two loaves of bread are lifted up in a wave offering. This is the Shabuah harvest. It is less than 2 years from now, and it will reap the covenant family, a marvelous harvest of the covenant's children. And this is the Zeruah's principal mission. Zeruah means one who sows the seeds and cultivates them for a productive and fruitful harvest. As I mentioned, Moshe was the first Zeruah, Dod the second. Dod is by far the most important Zeruah because it also means sacrificial lamb. And I am the third. And so the Zeruah is going to be the subject that carries out all the rest we're going to read throughout this 17:5 and 17:6. And there are many places where we are introduced to this cultivating role, this role of cultivating these harvests so that Yahweh's promises are fulfilled.
Mm-hmm.
It's given by Solomon on his Sermon on the Mount, speaking of the Nakri. It is listed before one of the most profoundly important prophecies regarding Dode's fulfillment of Passover as the Passover lamb, where it begins by saying, this is going to be understood and shared with you by the one who's come to know who the three Zeruah actually are. It is presented throughout Yahweh's testimony. It is also presented multiple times, even in the presentation of Dode's song, the 89th Mizmor, relative to the Son of God and Messiah. So all that follows is the result of what Yahweh is doing through his final Zeruah, the one that's cultivating these harvests. The first of them is Shavuah. It is the harvest of standing grain. In addition, there will be a time certain, that which is similar to a rapid gleaning of what is left and a final ingathering to be quickly prepared and removed, a lakat. A lakat is a time of a very rapid work. There's not to do a lakat, you're going through in this case, it's an olive grove that has been harvested previously. You have very little time to try to glean some of the fruit. You're going to leave some behind. You're going to take some. It is a secondary, tertiary harvest, if you will, and yes. It transpires very, very quickly. So it's a sudden event. And so there's going to be a gleaning of what is left and a final ingathering to be quickly prepared and removed, a lakat of first fruits flowing from one place to another in linear fashion. This shabolim, primary meaning is to be like a river, shimmering river that doesn't weave back and forth, but goes very rapidly from one place to another. So when the prophet Yeshayah saw the results of these two harvests, he said, it looks like a river of light to me. And he's speaking of the souls that are making this journey from earth Eretz to Shamaim.
Wow.
In the profound depths, he said that this is taking place in the profound depths of Raphaim, and where there is a place called Raphaim, it's not far from Jerusalem, southwest, I believe, of Jerusalem. It is what it means that is why it's being used here. It's where the sick have been healed. It's where the defective have been restored. And also where the feeble falter and the swords of the souls of the dead remain. So, two harvests, different times, different nature. One's wheat, the other one is olives. One is a major harvest, the other one is a gleaning. Got it? That's the story in Yeshayah 17:5, all orchestrated by Yahweh Zeruah, the one cultivating the seeds that are sown for his harvest. Now, this brings us to one of the most amazing installments of prophecy pursuant to our time that I have ever read.
Mm-hmm.
Yeshayah's insights are going to take us to a place we could not have imagined. And yet, every word of it has been there for us to read for 27 centuries. And he will remain. Who's he talking about? There's only one person he's talking about here.
The Zeruah.
The Zeruah. And he will remain. Wait a minute. The harvest of the last minute harvest of Yisraelites and Yehudim, of the chosen people. And wait a minute, you're telling me that the harvester is going to remain? Washa'ar, not what I wanted to read. And he will remain enduring, being left behind as flesh and blood. For having caused people with physical bodies to be spared as a remnant. Then acting as kin in a close relationship, speaking of the Zoroa, he will stay behind, his body serving as a reminder for the remainder of the extended family who are still leavened, a remnant of blood relations left over and remaining as physical beings when this is written identical to Sha'or, leaven, Sha'ar, a remnant, a remainder, and a residue, and Sha'ir, physical body comprised of flesh and blood, corporeal mass of meat, blood relative. It was written in the Nifl, perfect, third person, masculine, singular. Now, keep in mind, Zoroa is a feminine noun. Yahweh uses feminine nouns and masculine nouns as titles for the men who work with him. And he has his reasons for doing so, but Zoroa is a feminine noun, and yet he is referring to this individual as he, because he be me, and last time I checked, I was male.
Yeah.
Well, Yahweh does this a lot, not just with you, but with Dode.
Yeah, a lot, yeah, a lot. It's very, very, very common. You know, Dode is the great Zoroa. Zoroa is a feminine noun.
Yahweh's name is.
So he will remain enduring, being left behind as flesh and blood, for having caused people with physical bodies to be spared as a remnant during it. During it means during Teruah. Mm-hmm. So as this final harvest of Yisraelites and Yehudim, as we're going to find out, this is an olive harvest, leave this planet on what will be a Shabbat, September 23rd of 2033, just 10 days prior to Yahweh and Dode's return, the Zoroa doesn't get to go. He's left behind as something that what one would not expect, because when Yahweh is sending Eliyah and Yada back to earth as the final witnesses, they are the furthest thing from flesh and blood. The world is going to do everything, the religious and the political, including Satan himself, who's going to take residence in Jerusalem. They're going to do everything they possibly can. Now, remind you now, Jerusalem is the capital of an Islamic state of Fakistan. They're going to do everything they can to kill them. These two men, Eliyah and Yada, the Zoroa, are going to take up residence on the Temple Mount. The Al-Aqsa Mosque is going to be obliterated, Dome of the Rock is going to be obliterated, and working with Moloch, we will be erecting a replica of the Ohel Moed, the tabernacle and tent of the witnesses to the restoring testimony. And this will be the platform upon which we speak to the world, all while Yahweh displays signs above us, everything from Yada Yahweh to eventually even the Ark of the Covenant to the two tablets of stone. There's going to be miraculous signs in the sky that Yahweh is going to make available, and these two individuals are going to be shot at and missiles and bombs, and yet they're not going to die, because not only is the Temple Mount protected by Malachim, but so are they.
Mm-hmm.
So these are people that can speak to everybody and anybody at any one time. And if they tire of the discussion, since there's so little time left, and they just think that person is better gone, they will be able to incinerate them with their words. This is the opposite of what you would expect to read, as we'll be left behind as flesh and blood. When I translated that a few days ago, my heart sunk. My gut tightened up into a knot. Because I have known for quite some time, and it just didn't say it, I was going to be sacrificed at this time. And I came to know it because of what is written by Satan in his autobiography and playbook called Ezekiel, mm-hmm. where he has this feast called the Feast of the Beast, and he chooses the Gabor at that time to sacrifice, and he eats their flesh and he drinks their blood. And so that was my introduction to this. And then I'm reading earlier that Yahweh tells us that the moon will become blood.
Mm-hmm.
And in this relationship that Dode and I have together, he is the sun. I reflect his life. And so there's a sun-moon relationship, and that's many times where Yahweh compares the role I'm playing as Dode's herald, reflecting Dode's attributes, to the one who's coming back as brilliant as the sun. And so I realized I had another affirmation as Bloody Moon. And so I read this and said, I think Yahshayah has just told me my future.
Yeah.
But we're not done. But we're not done. Thrust aside and left on the stems and branches. Thrust aside. Forcibly away. This is an interesting word. You don't see it very often. It's olia. Olia. It's from alal, which means to deal harshly, to divert, to thrust aside. So thrust aside and left on the stems and branches. What this means is that this tabernacle that has been on Mount Moriah, that has been filled with this a number of Yisraelites and Yehudim, prior to Teruah, as we've been there speaking now for 42 months, they're all leaving and going to heaven on Teruah. And there's going to be a whole lot of people that want to be among them, or that are going to want to pull people out of them. You know how rabbis are so insistent that they reclaim their own. So it's going to be a very contentious time, and there's a number of people. I'm going to say, wait a minute, you're still leavened. You are not prepared to go. You're going to stay. And I'm not saying this now in a mean sort of way, because these individuals are being given a second chance, and I'm giving it to them. So it says, thrust aside and left on the stems and branches, as would be the case when an olive tree is beaten from all around to shake some of the fruit. You may not know, but that is how an olive tree was harvested. You'd take a branch or a stick, which is what the chota represents, and you'd beat the tree and the olives fall down, and that's how you'd harvest them. And so in this case, that chota branch is striking the tree, but he is not striking off all the olives. Some he's forcibly keeping on those branches, so that there are mature olives in the top, it says mature olives, two or three, in the top most crucial and foremost, barosh, the uppermost and choicest, directly from the source who initiated all things, from the one who leads from the summit of the first and finest mountain, even the most crucial. Vocal branch who speaks, promises and relates. This is a term that Yahshayah pulled out of obscurity. It's Amir. It means talkative stick, talkative branch. It's saying that the choder, who is a secondary branch or stem, is verbose. It's okay. There you go. As I say, I represent that statement. Four or five.
The Dode talked about that in Daniel. He called you the talkative one.
Yes, the talkative one. Well, that's the job. I mean, I am the call of Yahweh at this time. That is the job. And,
right.
And evidently it's inherited, because my father, he's talkative too. And so is my brother. Dode is very talkative. So I have it from good company. It is an inherited trait. Even though I will have a score to settle with Yasha Ya for poking fun at a talkative stick. But nonetheless, it's the part that comes next that ripped my heart out.
Okay.
It says 4 or 5 in the clefts of, well, there's something that comes before it. 4 or 5, Yasha Ya was not done poking fun. 4 or 5 in the clefts of his crag, the fissures, the crevices, and the cracks of this crag, from his branches which have been broken off. That is to say, my name is Craig. It is from Welsh. It means crag. The same word. It's just now saying that I'm showing the battle scars of having lived a long life and the crevices and creases that you would have as an old man. So the talkative stick is now have his battle scars, and he's old, but he's using those crevices and cracks and fissures to protect this group of 4 or 5 olives that has come from the branches that are broken off. Now, the top olives of the tree are Yehudim, and the branches that have been broken off, those are Yisraelites. Of the fruitful and productive heifer, of the one cultivating a flourishing and abundant harvest on behalf of future generations, Parah, of the one reaping what has been sown, producing offspring for future generations, and a female cow, prophetically declares Yahweh, God of Yisrael, individuals who engage and endure with God. Oh, my goodness. Fruitful is just fine. That's the purpose of the Zeruah. Productive is just fine. That's the purpose of the Zeruah. And Parah means fruitful and productive. But Parah is also the Hebrew word for heifer. And if I say red heifer, bloody red heifer, you know what happens to the red heifer, don't you?
Yes, cousin Hank.
He's killed brutally.
Mm-hmm.
He's hammered to death. And then he's incinerated. And then out of his ashes, the remnant of Yisrael is reconciled in advance of God's return so they can enter his presence. Now you read this and you say, oh my. The man who wrote the textbook on proper chodering just said on Teruah, as you escort the last of the harvestable souls from earth to heaven, just 10 days away from your king's return, you're going to be killed. And you're not, this is not just like a normal death. This is a very extensive story is what's going to happen. I am fairly certain that you noticed, as we just try to review what we have just read and heard, that Shavuah is a katzir. That's a harvest. It's followed by Teruah, which is a lakat, which is a gleaning 7 years later. But on this day, during Teruah, there is an oleah caused by the choder stem when whacking away at the olive tree. In addition to the olives, which are gleaned, there will be 7 olives thrust aside and left on the branches. They will not be part of the lakat. And since this was prefaced by Sha'ar, we know that they will remain in physical bodies while the Zeruah will be reduced to flesh and blood during Teruah. Also interesting, as a play on words, Yasha Ya is affirming the obvious. The Choder is a mirror. He's verbose. He is also a crag, with the cracks and crevices to show his age and battle scars earned along the way. And while we have known that the Zoroa is fruitful as a result of the actionable root of the title, which is Zera, sowing seeds, this is the first time that the one cultivating the Moedim and the Katsar has been identified as a para, as a productive heifer. And of that, there are some extraordinary implications. If I may be personal for a moment, yesterday I was translating the prophecy regarding the bloody moon. I realized that I was going to be sacrificed by my adversary, the adversary, Satan, during the final month of the 42 months as a witness and as the Zoroa calling Yisrael out of the world to Yahweh for the Teruah gleaning and Kippurim homecoming and reunion. And I had thought up to the point of being sacrificed that this was really an important job. We need to awaken the world so that there is a bountiful harvest of covenant members on Shavuah and then 7 years later on Teruah, and so that there are as a remnant of Yisrael and Yehudim that are awaiting Yahweh's return with Dod, that know the role Dod played in their restoration, and that understand Yahweh by name and know that he's coming back on this day, and they're prepared to meet him. I didn't think I would be asked to go beyond that. So at the time, I had thought there was nothing more to this than my role as the bull of Shavuah and Kippurim. If for those who do not know, the bull is the first and primary item on the menu for Shavuah, and it's the bull's blood that enables the high priest, in Aaron's case, and soon Dod, to return and approach the mercy seat of the Ark of the Covenant, where the blood of the bull is spattered upon it. And so I figured with my blood sprinkled on the mercy seat to allow Yisrael to approach their God, that's no big deal. Who wouldn't give some for the cause? Now, however, based upon Yashiah's pronouncement, I know the day I'm going to die, and I know the reason why it's going to matter. But before I decode what is currently the most discussed and least understood of the Torah prophecies, that of the red heifer, I want to explain what is happening in Yashiah 17, 4 through 6. So if we pull back to see the bigger picture into which this prophecy will play out, we find that the consensus of world leaders their consensus will be that Muslims, who moronically are called Palestinians, and these are the very people who have been killing, raping, enslaving, and persecuting Jews as Muslims since 622 CE, that they somehow deserve a autonomous state with the same borders Muslims violently rejected in the 1948 War of Independence, in the 1967 Six-Day War, in the 1973 Yom Kippur War, in the 1987 First Intifada, in the 1993 Oslo Accords, in the 2005 Gaza Disengagement, in the 2002 Intifada, and the 2023 Hamas Massacre. Despite the grotesque and appalling immorality of rewarding mass murdering terrorists with a state carved out of the heartland of the people who they have sought to annihilate, Yahweh affirmed 2,700 years ago that the insane would occur, with many progressive Jews promoting their own demise. Once this occurs, especially in the most anti-Semitic climate in world history, and with 2 billion demonic Muslims surrounding Israel, calling for the nation's demise, Israel will begin fighting a losing and deadly battle for its very right to exist, not wanting his covenant family to witness or endure the sadistic carnage, nor fall victim to it, Yahweh will be orchestrating the Shavuah harvest of standing grain on May 22nd, 2026, in concert with his Zeruah. 3.5 years later, on the 1st of Abib, which will be the 4th of April in 2030, Yahweh is going to return with the greatest orator of all time, Elia. Their mission will be to expose and condemn the adversary. Now, Elia was also a bit verbose, so this will be an interesting mix.
Yeah.
So now, but Elia was a very, very funny man. Now stirring the pot in corporeal form while denouncing religion and politics. At the same time, the two witnesses will be encouraging Jews to avail themselves of the Teruah olive. By design, not everyone is going to be withdrawn. There are going to be, is going to be a remnant of Israelites at the family reunion and the homecoming. We're not taking them all on Teruah. So the Choder, after beating the olive tree to glean its first fruits, will forcibly leave other olives, two or three on the top branch and four or five in protected fissures of the crack. Their instructions will be to do as Yahweh specifies in Bamidbar 19. That is, once I am torturously and publicly sacrificed, my heart likely eaten and some of my blood guzzled by the corporeal manifestation of Satan, whom I will allow to do this. Now, mind you, I'm going to be on the Temple Mount. It is completely surrounded by Moloch. I have been filled up to this point with the seven spirits of Yahweh. No Muslim, no demon, particularly Satan, can come even more near me.
Yeah.
And yet, on this day, I will have them all stand down and back away. Mm-hmm. And just as Elia said, I'm going to meet with Ahab on this day, I will meet with the adversary that I have fought bitterly over what now will be 32 years. And I'm going to allow he and his minions, which will be Muslims, to murder me. My body will be openly displayed as a trophy, which I suspect will be on the Temple Mount. I say this not only because of the prophecy, but also because prior to this time, I will have cleansed Moriah of the nastiness of the dome and the mosque. And this is actually good news, as it conveys the fate I will have chosen for reasons that we will all appreciate momentarily. Therefore, in this treatise on proper chodering written by Elia, and now as we come to recognize the and respond, really, to this role that Yahweh has established for the Zeruah, we find what is perhaps the most challenging declaration of all to process. It says that I'm going to allow Satan to slaughter me so that when the surviving remnant responds as instructed, Yisrael will live, properly prepared to witness and celebrate Kippurim. They have to be prepared to enter God's presence.
Yeah.
And all that were prepared to enter God's presence were just harvested the evening before.
Yeah.
So now as we consider this prophecy of the red heifer, know that the first time a red heifer was recognized in Israel was on a Friday, April 5th, 2002. It was during Bikurim, firstborn children in that year, which was either shortly after or right during my first and only visit to Israel. I was there. Also, just as the Zeruah is a feminine noun and it's used to describe three men, in this role, the bullish nature of the final Zeruah is being depicted as a fruitful and productive heifer. I'm going to play a song first that my wife wrote the evening that she came to my office, and I was beginning to share this and said, in fact, she didn't even give me the chance to get to the end of the verse and said, "So you're the heifer." This is the song. so that you know, the title of her song is Zacharon. Zachar in Hebrew has two meanings. The first is man. The second is to remember. And the own ending means to remember everything about this man. Then Yahweh spoke to Moshe, the one who draws out, and to Aaron, the alternative. This is a inscribed prescription for living of the Torah, teaching and guidance, which to enjoy the benefits of the relationship is instructed and authoritatively directed, because it is appointed and it is assigned by Yahweh. He spoke to affirm and to promise. Speak and tell, Bene Yisrael, children who engage and endure with God, to choose to accept, obtain and grasp hold of for yourselves. Adama Para, the bloody red man on the ground who is fruitful as a red heifer. Moral, innocent, and perfected, entirely right and truthful, who in showing the proper way, there is not any shame or guilt as a result of the relationship. It has never taken up or carried on it a yoke as a means of control or burden. Bob Midbar in the Wilderness, Numbers 19:2. Now this is being conveyed to Moshe and Aaron because it is both part of Yahweh's written instructions to Yisrael and specifically for someone serving in the role of Aaron in the anointing, the approach to the covenant home and to the mercy seat. It is a chukka, an inscribed prescription for living. It pertains to those who are willing to read what they must do if they wish to live. This is part of Yahweh's Torah guidance and direction. And those who act upon it will asher, enjoy the benefits of the relationship. Specifically, Yahweh has not only appointed and assigned this responsibility to someone of his choosing, he is offering authoritative directions on how to benefit from what he intends to accomplish. This Shawa instruction was pronounced and written on behalf of the children of Yisrael. It applies to them. God's people are encouraged of their own free will to lakach, accept, obtain, and grasp hold of for themselves. An Adama Para, a bloody red man on the ground, who has been fruitful and productive, who is now designated as a red heifer. But what is that? Why was it described that way? And where would one find such a thing, much less do with it? Well, to begin, Adam and Adama convey much more than ruddy or bloody red. Adam is the name of Yahweh's companion in the garden. It is used throughout the Torah and Navi to convey man. As Adama, it also means dirt, earth, or ground. So this is a bloody red man. Mm-hmm. While revealing the primary meaning of para is to be fruitful, which is the role of the Zeroah who is cultivating the Shabua Katsir and the Terua Lakat. In the previous prophecy in Yashaya, he concluded his prophecy with Parah, specifically to address the fruitful and productive nature of the Zeroah pursuant to these harvests. It was his remark, of course, that led us to contemplating the example here of the red heifer. Since the Zeroah's contributions to the Katzir is the reason the par, the bull, is sacrificed on Shavuah and is used to anoint the mercy seat during Kippurim, Parah speaks of a fruitful and productive par, bull, which in nature is a Parah heifer. Men as bulls can stamp out devilish men. They can stamp out demonic spirits, according to Yahweh's prophets. They can break up religious cults. They can defend God's people. But bulls don't give birth. The purpose of the red heifer is to give the remnant of Yisrael new life.
Mm-hmm.
And in nature, the life givers are women. Therefore, all of these connotations apply. Well, Yada, as the Zeroah is Adam, a man, in his present Bashar body, Parah fruitful like a Zeroah, cultivating the harvest, and both are feminine, as is the Nefesh soul residing in and animating both. And following the sacrifice, the Nefesh will be all that remains of this once bold bull. In this case, since the Adamah Parah is now a bloody red man tossed on the ground, treated appropriately now in accordance with the Torah's instructions, he will become the Parah heifer, giving Israel new life, which of course is a feminine role. According to the Torah, the Adamah Parah is Tamim, which is to say that he is a beneficiary of Pesach and Matzah and has been perfected. All the while, he has been Tamim, moral, truthful, right. In so doing, he has Ashar shown the proper way to receive the benefits of the relationship. Now, in this opening pronouncement, we find mum, which is an uncommon word, and it was negated by ain, which reveals the Adamah Parah has nothing to be ashamed of, and that while he has been wrongly slandered and inappropriately mocked, he as the man bull, she as the soul heifer, is without guilt. From Yahweh's perspective, the Adamah Parah is a perfect sacrifice. It is intriguing that the Adamah Parah red heifer has never been, Oel, yoked. That is to say, he, she has never been controlled or burdened by anyone. The Adamah Parah works and lives independently of human influences and is therefore unaffected by religion, politics, or economic pressures. That is describing my current existence. It is why when I asked Yahweh if I could forego writing the 5 volumes of Goddamn Religion by translating the Quran again and setting it in the context of Muhammad's disgusting life, because it's like a trip through hell, Yahweh said, I have taken care of you. Now take care of my people. Now beyond this, Ol shares the same root of Alal, which is the actionable root of Olia, which was the most revealing term in the Yeshayah 17:6 prophecy regarding those who were deliberately and forcibly thrust aside and left behind by the Zeroah. And that occurred during Teruah. This is Yahweh's way of foreshadowing with the prophecy hinting at its fulfillment. As we consider what is revealed next, there are two options, one far more likely than the other. In fact, I am now certain. But either one is possible, and it could be that one of the Yehudim that the Zeruah has deliberately left on the uppermost branch will act in the role of priest while supported by God. Or Elazar is my fellow witness, the prophet Elia. Now, I'm expecting the latter. And then we know that, because if that's true, we'll know that all of this will be accomplished correctly, because he is a prophet and he does not make mistakes. But as we progress through here, we're going to find God verify exactly who Elazar actually is. Numbers 19:3 reads, "And you should give that which is associated with it to Elazar, the one supported by God, the one acting in the role of priest and royal advisor. He will bring what is associated with it out, withdrawing and removing it as in an exodus, yatzah of God, from out of the public place of the militant fighters laid siege. They will have slaughtered it, bludgeoning it without resistance. Shekhath. They will have beaten and killed him at the time, literally hammering him to death for having offered his life." It's written in the Call Perfect third person masculine plural from the Dead Sea Scrolls 4Q27 numbers. All in association with this, before his presence and in front of him. By using Nathan, the Adama Parah is a gift. It's offered to the surviving remnant of Israel. Therefore, he, like Moshe, would precipitate an exodus, a yatzah, removing the children of Israel from the horrendous situation in which they find themselves. Well, we are not told if a man named Elazar will be among the remnant that the Zeruah leaves behind, if he is the mighty Elia, although God certainly hints at it, or if this name means that those tasked with this responsibility will have God's unconditional support. All of these are possible, with one more likely than the other. What is certain is this individual will be a descendant of Jacob, and he's going to be keenly aware of the roles of Moshe and Aaron, and he will be performing each of their roles relative to the instructions which follow. The verb yatzah should be eminently familiar to Jews, because it is the one that Yahweh chose to designate the exodus from Mitzrayim, the crucibles of religious and political oppression. And that is to say, the Adama Parah will be initiating the final exodus, withdrawing the remnant of Yisrael from Babel, the intermixing and confusing commingling of religion and politics, born and bred by the Lord, Satan himself, in Babylon. At this point, the Adam, bloody red, Shechat, bludgeoned body of the Zeruah, which was Shekhat, slaughtered in the presence of Satan, will have been tossed on the Adama ground in public view as a warning and as a trophy. It will be surrounded by the sadistic militants who beat him to death while praising their wannabe god, Allahu Akbar. Therefore, with Elazar supported by the actual God, he will follow his instructions, which will be to remove the body from being a public spectacle. And since Yada will have raised the Dome of the Rock and Al-Aqsa Mosque, the remnant of Yisrael Oliah left behind will be retrieving it from these monstrosities that were built to appease Satan and that once scarred the Temple Mount. The Zoroa's sacrificial death at the hands of those serving the beast will not be quick. It won't be painless. He will be shachat, beaten to death, with something akin to hammers. And this way, his experience will be somewhat similar to what Dode endured when whipped and crucified by Romans as an excruciating public. After all, the purpose of the herald, this final Zoroa, is to reflect the life of the Messiah and Son of God, his King, Dode. I shared with this with you before, but it bears repeating. In Ezekiel, which is Satan's autobiography and playbook, he bragged that he will take the life of this Gabor, this competent and courageous man of God. He then boasts that he will eat his flesh and drink his blood during what I have dubbed the Feast of the Beast. I've known this for some time, and I've known that I would be on the menu. And this means that prior to being downgraded to a lowly serpent, Satan, once as a cherub, would have been able to see his future, which he then shared with Ezekiel in Babylon. Satan has witnessed this, and he had it written in the book of Ezekiel. This known, the ghoulish display of cannibalism and drinking blood, well, like a good practicing Catholic, by the corporeal manifestation of Halal bin Shakar, will be mostly symbolic. One swig, a quick chomp, neither to his liking. But with his ego satiated, Satan will walk away, leaving my body behind. And this, with Yahweh's assistance, will make the Adama Para retrievable. Now, the parallel to this is introduced in the preparations for the initial feast in connection with the covenant. It was a presentation that I never understood until really this week. But in Bereshit, in Genesis 15:9, in advance of their first meal together in the Bereth, Yahweh asked Abraham to obtain, to approach me, a heifer, to establish a pattern that will repeat, an eglah, a female cow from Agol, to demonstrate what will happen now and what will reoccur. Who is three, as well as the third in the series? The Zoroa, now cast in the role of the red heifer, will be 3 years into his second life when this occurs. Mm-hmm. Now, should someone think I'm reaching, think again. Not only are both stories presented within the Torah and recorded by the first Zoroa, the same verb will be deployed, lakash, obtain and take. The purpose is also the same, which is to approach God, who is now returning for his covenant family, just in a matter of days, even to enjoy a celebratory meal. It gets better. The word chosen to convey heifer was eglah, revealing two essential insights. First, Yahweh was establishing a pattern of conduct that would repeat itself, coming full circle, with respect to participating within the covenant. And second, by using eglah to depict the heifer on the first occasion, when God spoke of a parah thereafter, there is something inherent in these words which is essential to understanding his explanation. And we found it in both. Eglah affirms that the bereth will be reestablished through a heifer. And Parah reveals that the final occasion is going to be through a man, Adam, who has been notably productive and fruitful, which is the very definition of Zeruah. And of course, Yeshayah led us to this prophecy by using Parah in connection with the Zeruah productivity during the Shavuah and Teruah harvests, and now beyond. As a matter of fact, when we turn to Numbers 5 and we read the reason that this must happen, we're going to find that God talks about a reconciliation, an offer to restore Yisrael that goes beyond what occurs on the fifth. The fifth moed is Teruah. This is what happens over and above it. And he says specifically that this is being done to augment the work of the ram on reconciliations. Now here, even shalosh, which means three and third in a series, is insightful. Just as Dod arrived 3 years before serving as the Passover lamb, Yada will return 3 years in advance of being sacrificed as the red heifer. Of course, Yada is the third and final Zeruah. Now, as for the other animals, Yahweh specified a goat and a ram, and also of the same age. Yahweh called the goat an Ez, which is written Ein Zayin, just like El Azar, which is Ein Zayed Rosh. Ez, in addition to goat, means physically and mentally strong, capable, and therefore helpful. And the scapegoat, whose blood is splattered on the mercy seat, is an Azazel. It is derived from the same verb, azab, which means to separate, forsake, and damn. As noted, El-Azar concludes with a Rosh, which tells us that this particularly powerful and capable, strong and helpful man of God is observant and thoughtful.
Mm-hmm.
He is just as I suspected. It's Eliyah. Returning to the debut of the Eglah, reoccurring heifer, foreshadowing Teruah, and the Ez, capable and influential goat, foreshadowing Kippurim, Yahweh added, can't catch this, an A.L. ram, bringing his son Dod into the mix as the harbinger of Pesach and the Pesach A.L. They were all there, three and a third in a series. This is because all three men, Yada, Eliyah, and Dod, the heifer, the goat, and the ram, would live three lives, each playing their part to fulfill the three Mikrei. And all three will have been brought back 3 years in advance of their mission. Each
a
of the three.
That will repeat.
Wow.
Yep.
Wow.
Each of the three would be cut in half, with Abraham passing between them, symbolizing of how the covenant would be formed based upon what all three accomplished during the first of their two lives. But let's not leave Moshe out. He was represented by Tor, which is the masculine form of Torah. Perhaps you've heard of it. It's one long life was exemplary, and he was retired after a job well done. He did his job better than the other two of us as Zeruah. He gets the gold watch and retirement party. So he was not cut in two. And lastly, there was a Gazal, a young songbird. I like to think of her as the songwriter and singer of Yada Yahweh, tasked with sharing God's message with his people while Gazal, tearing them away from religion and politics. Perhaps you've heard of her. Her name is Dee.
Yeah.
So now that we're familiar with the players, let's continue with Yahweh's story. I'm going to share one more, and I think we would be wise to conclude and pick this up next week. We might even have a new song on the Red Heifer next week by our our beloved songwriter. Okay, so let's commence with Bob Midbar in the Wilderness, Numbers 19:4.
Okay.
Now, Eleazar, the one supported by God, Eliah, the one acting in the role of a priest, will obtain and take a portion from its blood with his finger and sprinkle and spatter it in the vicinity and towards the direction of the appearance or presence of the Oel, the home of the Moed, restoring witness. Just from part of its blood. Seven strokes. Every word of this has meaning. Eliah, who is the one supported by God and acting in the role of Koran priest, serving the remnant of Yehudim and Yisrael, who were left behind. Now, mind you, if you're bothered by a ordinary non-Levite Yisraelite serving in the role of a Kohen, you ought not be, because Dode historically has put on the garb of a high priest and danced with the arrival of the Ark of the Covenant, and it is Dode who is going to perform in the role of high priest and anoint the Kippurah, the mercy seat of the Ark of the Covenant. And so in this case, Yahweh is using the returning Eliah to perform in this role. So he will serve as this high priest on behalf of the remnant of Yehudim and Yisrael who have been left behind. And he is depicted obtaining a portion of the Adama Paraz, the red heifer's blood, at the beginning and the conclusion of this statement, but only using one portion of it. And that means he's saving the other. The procedure he will follow will be to do as Aaron had done and Dode will do, dipping a finger into the blood and then spattering seven drops on it toward the object of Yahweh's choosing. After all, it's the blood of the par bull, which makes it possible for the priest to approach the Kippurah, mercy seat of the Ark of the Covenant on Yom Kippurim, such that the blood of a goat can be added for the benefit of the people. Eliah will be adding his to mine. On this occasion, now less than 10 days before Dode's arrival to do this very thing, the one assisting God will sprinkle a portion of blood he has collected from the Adama Parah, this fruitful man as the red heifer, El Nokach, in the vicinity of Paneh, the presence of the Oel Moed, home of the restoring witness. Now, there are two separate ways to interpret this, and the distinction between them is actually quite small. Eliah and Yada will have been working on site in Jerusalem for the past 42 months. The expectation is that they won't be staying at the King David Hotel, but will instead have lived in tents pitched on the Temple Mount, which have been erected and protected by Malachim. The one occupied by the Adama Parah would serve as the home of the restoring witness. Should this tent have been sufficiently large, it might also have been shared with the recently gleaned members of the covenant family prior to their departure on the Shabbat evening of Teruah. Mm-hmm. Now, an equally viable option in this same location would be that Yada and Eliah, with the help of Yahweh's Malachim, have erected a replica of the Oel Moed, representing the original tabernacle of the radiant tent, to the witness of the restoring meetings, doing so in the proper location. After all, since Satan will want to build his own ostentatious temple to himself on the site, and since Yada is allergic to all things Islamic, the Temple Mount would have been cleared for the occasion. Also, it's the best platform in the world for these two men to witness to Yahweh's testimony.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Now, so as a related possibility, since Yahweh will be orchestrating the display of signs in support of his witnesses, including displaying the Yada Yah series of books, all above the Temple Mount, one of the most spectacular displays would be for him to project a hologram of light, reestablishing the outline of his future home.
Wow, that's good. That's cool.
Yeah.
Seven strokes is initially symbolic of the realizations that the Choder has been imbued with the seven spirits of Yahweh, and that there are seven Moedim leading to man, leading mankind to God's home. With the fifth Moed now fulfilled and the sixth looming, this is a marvelous way to encourage the remnant to stay the course. I find it interesting as well that the spattering is coming by way of Sheba Pa'am, seven strokes, because it suggests that we have moved well past Moshe being asked to speak to the rocky crag and now to striking it. I think I want to go one further just because it's hard to walk away from this material.
Yeah.
What follows is really exceptionally unique. There is nothing exactly like this that anywhere else in all of the Torah Anabi, at least up to this point. Although there is another spectacular example of burning a bull, and it was done in a similar context, showing Yahweh's supremacy over the religious and political elite. And that time it was orchestrated by none other than the man who will be arranging the following spectacle. Hell yeah.
Yeah.
Probably my favorite story in the whole of the Torah and Prophets is what Eliyah did as the dress rehearsal for what he will do on this day.
Yes.
Then that which is associated with HaPerah, the fruitful cow, he is to be consumed by fire. It's going to be burned in his presence and sight, with its body and skin exposed to arouse, awaken, and alert, along with the bashar, corporeal flesh of the herald. In addition to its blood, over its viscera, fecal matter, and the contents of its stomach and intestines, burned as if incinerating a venomous serpent. Just as the mutilated remains, that, by the way, was Numbers 19:5. Just as the mutilated remains of Dode's body as the Passover lamb were incinerated 2,000 years prior to this event, the bludgeoned body of the red heifer will be engulfed in flames. And just as the Messiah serving in the lamb would be bludgeoned by the beast of Rome, the bloodiest and most sadistic enemy of Israel at the time, his herald will be ravaged by today's bloodiest and most sadistic beasts, Muslims, acting at the behest of their god, Satan, who is also known as Allah. But this is just the beginning of the many similarities between the Zeroah, these two Zeroah, both representing sacrificial animals to carry out their missions. Now, personally, unlike most Jews, I have always favored cremation over being consumed by worms. Mm-hmm. So it's nice to see that my bashar is going to be incinerated, as was the case with Dode's bashar, his corporal body, following Pesach exactly 40 Yobel previously in this exact same locale. But you'll notice, as was the case with Dode serving as the Yael, the Parah is not consumed as part of the feast. In both cases, their physical bodies are purely sacrificial. And as was the case with Dode, the nephesh soul lives on, now unburdened by the mutilated flesh. Now, there are many reasons why Yahweh asked for a witness to what he will be orchestrating. And let's be clear. In this regard, because the sacrifice of the red heifer is prophetic, it's not historic. Until the time of my initial visit to Israel in early 2002, there had never been a red heifer in the Promised Land. And there is no indication in the Torah or prophets that these instructions were followed previously. So this is my funeral. And it is being orchestrated by Yahweh to achieve his purpose. By watching the fire consume the bloody and beaten flesh, the witnesses would see something horrible and useless and how it can be turned into something brilliant. The fire transforms dead and decaying organic material into light and energy, similar to the geometric enhancement and the empowerment that is offered through Bikurim and Shavua. Also, fire and light are beacons such that this elevating offering will be, or it's going to arouse, it's going to awaken and alert the remnant of Yisrael to Yahweh's imminent return. Without the benefit of the red heifer sacrifice, no one among this remnant would be prepared to live in God's presence. His very return would incinerate them. Now, as we shall soon see, as I share specifically what the heifer's ashes are resolving when mixed with water based upon Yahweh's Torah teaching in Bamidbar Numbers 5, it will become obvious that without this sacrifice on the cusp of Yahweh's return, no one would survive the homecoming. Ill-prepared, still bearing the religious and political guilt which has caused them to be left behind, still leavened, they would have been incinerated by the brilliance of Yahweh's and Dod's presence. Mm-hmm. So like it or not, Yisrael, in the end, you're saved by a goy. And it is as it should be, because Yahweh began with goyim, Adam, Chawa, Cain, Hebel, Noach, his wife, his sons, their wives, Abraham and Sarah, their nephew Lot, his daughters, and Abraham and Sarah's son and grandsons, Yishak, Jacob, and Esau, are all goy.
Mm-hmm.
So the last will be as the first, coming full circle, just as the covenant family will be returning to Gan Eden on Sukkah. Bashar, human herald, is one of Yada's titles. In the fire, the Zeroah turned Adama Parai is now the Bashar's, heralding the restoration of Yisrael in advance of his king's arrival on Kippurim. Throughout the Torah, dam, blood, is equated with Che life. It was shed so that Yisrael might live. It was even used to mark the door to heaven. And the souls who are lifted up in the wave offering, equated to the new wine of inheritance. Blood carries oxygen and nutrients, which are energy and fuel, to every cell of our bodies. Our blood not only carries the means to fight disease, it carries that which is not healthy away to be eventually discharged. Since the Adama Parah is serving as a reconciling sacrifice and is not a menu item for a feast, everything is burned together, from the viscera to the contents of the intestines. And considering that Muslim swine will have bludgeoned his body, it's covered in their shist. And that, too, must go. Picture Yahweh's painting is actually much bigger than that. While the red heifer has been declared perfect, he has been smeared with the religious and political rebellion of the remaining remnant. Therefore, we should look at the excrement being incinerated from the perspective of what occurred when Dod fulfilled matzah. Rather than being carried into Sheol, the religious and political guilt of Yisrael is now being incinerated and obliterated, thereby facilitating their reconciliation. So Dod is the king of redemption, while Yad is the prince of reconciliation. He is hauling away and disposing the remaining trash, hard to mention, the stench on this day. Now in this vein, Seraph, consumed in flames, is also the word for serpent, suggesting that he is now toast and his venom is no longer paralyzing and deadly. This, too, is important because the bull's business, according to Malachi, is to stamp out serpents. Satan is the lord of snakes. He's the god of religion. And this adversary is Yada's adversary. I'm going to force myself to stop here because this next statement is just bone-chilling, the way that Yahweh painted this picture so that you would see the sacrifice that Dod made and the one that is being made by the red heifer in parallel. They serve a very similar purpose, just at a different time.
Mm-hmm.
And one ushers in the arrival of the other.
Mm-hmm.
And the words that Yah chose for it just grab us by the heart.
Yes.
And you read it and you say, how is it that this could have been written 3,500 years ago?
Yeah.
And we're the first to explain its meaning. Well, I've promised that we will not go further. I appreciate you listening to us this evening again. This is not what we expected. I can assure you that if anybody had 1 ounce of jealousy and thought that maybe they should be the person who sits in my chair 13 hours a day.
I would rethink that.
Yeah, seven days a week and has done so for 23 years, they may want to think otherwise because of what the red heifer tells us is going to happen.
Well, you know, we appreciate you for 23 years. Mikey,
well,
yes. Being...
Yeah, I can tell you that for one moment yesterday after I had done these translations and I was just kind of sitting out taking in the view, thinking about what we had seen, I said, so, yeah, well, this sort of changes things, doesn't it? I mean, it's one thing for you to enable me and for me to show the devotion to reintroduce the world to your name and to explain what you're offering, what to expect in return, to reestablish your son's authority and credibility and to let the world know what Dod has done for them. It's been a great thrill and honor to cultivate these harvests, but now you're asking for a sacrifice of the ultimate magnitude.
Yeah.
And I then just laughed and I said, all right, well, Yahweh has a way of dealing with such things. Dod, the roaring lion of Judah, was reduced to a lamb on the most courageous and compassionate day of his life. And this bull who has so boldly and in degree bravely stamped out the credibility of Islam and Christianity, rabbinic Judaism, and has fought so hard to protect God's people, is rendered on this day a cow. Now, I think there's actually more to it than that, which is that lions and bulls are not sympathetic creatures. You expect them to do the goring and to do the gnawing, and we don't expect them to be the victims. And when they finally are, there's no tear shed. But when the sacrificial victim is the cutest of all animals and a lamb, and is defenseless as a cow, then we have a different reaction. I think that's the reaction that Jiawa is seeking in this particular case.
Yeah.
So with all of this said, we will return to this next week. We'll probably go over some of what we have shared so that we keep it all in context. But it is a great thrill and indeed an honor.
It is.
To be able to perceive and share for the first time the role of the red heifer. And as we will continue to explain what it means for the remnant of Yisrael, when it will happen, why it will occur, what will be achieved through it. And it is truly a great honor to be trusted by Yahweh to the extent that I'm not only willing to do this, but I'm thrilled to have the opportunity. Mm-hmm. May Yahweh bless. You have a wonderful Shabbat. We look forward to being with you this time next week. Good night.
Good night.
Happy Shabbat. Good night, Kirk.
You too. Thank you.
Hey guys, it is Ryan. I'm not sure if you know this about me, but I'm a bit of a fun fanatic when I can. I like to work, but I like fun too. And now I can tell you about my favorite place to have fun, Chumba Casino. They have hundreds of social casino style games to choose from with new games released each week. You can play for free and each day brings a new chance to collect daily bonuses. So join me in the fun. Sign up now at ChumbaCasino.com.
Sponsored by Chumba Casino. No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply.
WowVegas.com. Where you're a winner, baby.
Win at WowVegas.com, America's best social casino. With more than 900 free play games at your fingertips. Winners say wow when they play at WowVegas.com. Experience the real thrills of Vegas at home or on the go. Claim your free coins today at WowVegas.com.
WowVegas is a social casino. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited. Play responsibly. Conditions apply. See website for details.
WowVegas.com. Where you're a winner.